HubZero.org, a platform for scientific collaboration. You can follow along with this presentation by going to HubZero.org and downloading the corresponding slides. Enjoy the show.
And next up, we have Gerhard Klimek, who's the director of the Network for Computational Nanotechnology, the organization that created NanoHub, sort of our oldest and best example of a hub because it's been around for so long and has such a large user community. And I think Gerhard's going to be talking about the impact story and trying to explore the impact of NanoHub. So welcome, Gerhard.
Well, thanks, Michael. Thanks for hosting this event. And I'd like to take you through a little bit of a journey through time and try to measure impact on what we did with NanoHub. And one of the key impacts that we have had is Michael was my first hire. So the idea was really to really have impact with modeling and simulation on the world and create a system that can deliver that. So I decided I got to go after the best software developer that I know. There we go. And he did come to Purdue. So what you see here is an animation of NanoHub users of real data as they roam through the world. And red dots are users that come for tutorials, seminars, classes. And the yellow dots are a little bit more persistent. They are longer running simulations. People spend more time. You can kind of see they come online, they work through the night, and then they kind of go to bed at 2 or 3, and then they wake back up. And it's really across the globe. I showed this a couple of weeks ago in Australia, and one guy goes, "Oh, that's my class right there." It was really cool. So the point is, this thing is alive. It's operational 24/7, and that's a great way to show that. And there's going to be a presentation on this kind of data visualization tomorrow. So, but before I do this, I mentioned Michael in the beginning. So there's actually a whole lot of people working on this. So this is not all my work. And some of the my research work also comes from my past experience that also flows into NanoHub and some of the applications that I will show. I'll take you even further back, sort of the history of what my community does, which is working on transistors. And in 1965, a person called Gordon Moore sketched something into his notebook that is now becoming known as Moore's Law, which really sketches the number of components per integrated circuit and the exponential decay in cost. And that really set the stage for something rather revolutionary, where today you can buy a processor, a CPU, where you have 2 billion transistors working together in a cohesive and in a meaningful sense. Now imagine you have 6 billion people in the world working together in a cohesive, seemingly useful sense, right? So that's a tremendous achievement. And what happened is device integration. And that was made possible by making things smaller. So these devices are getting smaller and smaller to the nanometer scale. So what you might have heard, these things, these might have been incarnations of Moore's Law. What you probably not heard is that those are really enabled by two pieces of software. And if you knew that it was Berkeley SPICE, which is a circuit simulation, or in Stanford Supreme, which is a process modeling tool, you probably didn't know that those were class projects. Those were tiny pieces of software that started out literally as a class project and a teaching tool. And SPICE was one of the first open source pieces of code. And this person, Peterson, the professor that had this idea, his way of disseminating software was giving talks like this and carrying a tape around, right? And giving people a tape and said, "I know there's bugs in this software, but try it anyways and let me know when it's broken." So the assumption was never there of perfect quality control, something that will always work. So, by the way, Stanford also got wind of this and thought that we have to have impact like that, and they created a process modeling tool, also open source, similar venue. So the outcome of that is process simulation, circuit simulation, resulted ultimately in a worldwide industry of $280 billion. So the question now is, can you do something like that again? And could you base innovation on modeling and simulation in the nanometer scale and put them together? And the idea is really, we do have a cornucopia of research results. We create papers all the time. We create software all the time. But can you find ways that you can deliver that kind of output more rapidly into the real world. So we picked a couple of topics in the nano area, but the key element is putting it into the real world. So now the question is, can you do that? And how would you measure success? And what would you like to do? So the services we wanted to develop and deliver were modeling and simulation software. And we added seminars, tutorials, and classes into that. And then we wanted to be measured by certain goals. So these goals are, we wanted to have knowledge transfer. One of the quantitative ways to do that is useful work in classrooms. Knowledge generation, use in research, and one of the key goals was not used by computational geeks like me. I know what SSH is, what MPI is, I know how to log into a remote machine, but can we transfer the software that a Klimek-like person builds into experimentalist hands or into classrooms? We wanted to have economic impact, and we wanted to work on professional development and community building. So those are the key elements we wanted to succeed in and that we set out. So I'm going to give you an example of one of the pieces of software that we are running inside NanoHub. I'll tell you that I'm not just a manager. I actually do some research work myself. So this is Nemo 3D. This is a tool we built starting at JPL when I was there. This tool takes about 10 years to develop. So this is not something you just sort of build on the side. It's a serious tool. You basically map atoms into structures and calculate eigenstates of systems and then calculate in these artificial atoms properties like sensors and computing environments. This tool, later at Purdue then, we demonstrated runs quite linearly in terms of scaling, and we can demonstrate up to 52 million atom electronic structure calculations. That is unprecedented. There is no tool like that, and that means you can take a modern transistor into a domain of 100 by 100 by 100 nanometers and plop it in there and calculate the eigenstates of a system like that. And that might be a prototypical system, not a Mickey Mouse system like that, where you have a real geometry. So to give you a little bit of idea, what are these quantum dots? You can grow indium arsenide on gallium arsenide. They have two different lattice constants. They don't really like to grow in each other. So this indium arsenide sort of has to give way, and it needs to expand a little bit to the top. Think of Legos not quite fitting well. If you grow more of that stuff, indium arsenide will clump up. It'll gather together, and the cool thing is it gathers together in a very crystalline form, and then you cap it with this blue stuff again, gallium arsenide, and you get something like quantum dots. This is a very pictorial way of doing this. The real thing is, of course, more complicated. It looks more like this, where you might have about a million atoms in this domain, and you have disorder that is atomistic all around. So what happens here is you might cap it with some disorder here, and then the quantum dot might change shape ever so slightly. And that might be important, and you might want to model the mechanical movement of these atoms and the electronic structure. So that the dot can change shape slightly, and the upshot is that we can model geometries like that where we have experimental data, where people have tuned the optical emission of such quantum dot systems, and we can basically overlap theory and experiment. So we've enabled TCAD simulations on the nanometer scale. So that you might say, well, that's very fancy. You need special computers to do all this. But the goal is really to put this into people's hands. And what we have to do is work on algorithm computing and middleware. We have to impact research. We have to impact education. And we want to be open and available. And we all want to do that through NanoHub as a central mechanism to do that. So for this particular tool, we do this. We run on TerraGrid, we run on Open Science Grid, and on NanoHub. We demonstrated this, that can go to the petascale. We take this tool and take it to teachers and teach teachers. And then we put it onto the NanoHub and serve over 2,000 people in the world with such a tool. In a simplified form, not the full-fledged version, but nevertheless. In the next generation, we built something we call NEMO backwards, OMEN. And it runs on the largest supercomputer in the world, actually the second largest one. It broke through the petascale a couple of months ago. So we have sustained performance on the petascale. Again, you have to be very special to get on a resource like that. But we can take this tool and run it as an engine for 6 tools on the NanoHub and 6,700 users with over 100,000 simulations have performed on various forms of these tools and prototypes. So we can put it into the hands of real people, but we can do this for not just one tool or two, we do it for 190 tools. What is very unique here is that the normal proposal on web enabling anything reads like this. Give me 3 years and 3 people, and I will put one tool online in 3 years. I can guarantee you that we do not have 9 FTEs for each of those 190 tools and put them online. So we do something rather radically different, and that is what's enabled by NanoHub and Hub Zero technology. So we do this for tools. We have now 50 courses online and some 2,300 other resources. You've seen a brief demo of capabilities. So NanoHub is a web page in a sense. But it's, in a sense, being called by Apple vice president, also a nano app store. It's really an application store where people can find applications, but sophisticated science engines. So you've seen this chart. You've seen this animation here. The key is we're being used at all top 50 engineering schools in the U.S. and 19% of all .edu's. But so this thing is alive, right? And we actually don't know in detail what people do until we start to study it a little bit more. And how do we study impact and what are they doing? Because on their sign-up form, they might say, I might take a class, or they may not, or they might say, I do research. But that's all we kind of know. So what we really have here is the matrix, right? So you got to look into the matrix and figure out what's going on. And the way to do that is in the following. I will first give you some raw statistics. So in the academic year 09-10, we had 8,600 users running 345 simulations, and we had 116 classes at 97 institutions through self-registration. So we had to figure out, 1 in 20 people might say, I'm taking this class over here at this university, and another one might say, I took it with Professor so-and-so, so we need to send an email to Professor so-and-so. Really painful process. So we found 116 at 97 institutions. We also do Google Scholar searches and find 575 citations. So in the top level, we know we're being used in classes. We know we're being used in research. But that's not quite enough. It didn't satisfy my NSF panel as such. So the next questions are, so how many students are in a class? What tools do they use? What intensity of the use? Is it sustained? And what are you really, education or research, or education or research, or both? And what's the quantity? Right? Can you figure that out? So, and if we figured it out, we can actually improve our services. We could classify heavy educational tools as educational tools and praise them as such if somebody's looking for educational tools. And vice versa for research. By the way, we can prove now that there's tools that are simultaneously used in research and in education at the same time, same class of tool. All right, we can customize web pages, etc. We can do better research provisioning. So here I'm going to show you now the NanoHub matrix. And bear with me, it looks kind of complicated. So here's time. And each row is a user. So this person has come many times throughout the whole year and run different tools. And each dot is a speck of activity. Each color is a different tool. And then users seem to behave all very differently, which makes sense. What I'm going to do is now take you back in time, starting on June the 30th of last year, back in time and look at the activities starting from the first day when a user shows up. So I'm going to look at the NanoHub matrix that winds back in time. And it seems rather scattered, except you start to see some streaks here. Here's a streak. Here's a big streak, right? Here's 3 streaks, a chunk. Suddenly a big chunk of people. So some people are appearing completely random. Some people seem to be coordinated against each other. So we can run and develop algorithms. And again, there's a presentation on the details on some of that tomorrow, where we cross-correlate people's behavior. And we can identify out of this matrix behaviors like these. Single tool, single use for a single homework. Sustained use of a single tool throughout a whole semester. Multiple tools, sustained and periodic, so like this, multiple tools. And these ones are positively identified. I know who the teacher is at what university. So we can validate that our algorithms work. So these graphs are obtained by our numerical algorithms, but we can then validate against a few samples. There's other people that don't cross-correlate at all. Those are the research user and self-study type users. This, to me, is a quantitative proof of education because I actually can look at people's behavior. And remember, I mentioned 116 classes at 97 institutions. Now I find 150 courses or clusters at 120 institutions. And the really cool thing is it's 95% are outside the organization that I direct, meaning it's really going viral. It's being used all over the place without me having to go and twist people's eyes. It's really easy. Try it. All right. So this is a proof of use in research that's quantitative. So the next question is, can you do research? And I have to give you this backdrop. When we started this, our nanoelectronic background community implied that you build your tool, otherwise you're nobody. You cannot do real research if you don't build your own tools. So for many people on the review panels that were evaluating us, it was inconceivable that you can do research altogether. So what I'd like to show you now is a proof that you can do research. And the way you do that is you go in the literature and search for references to NanoHub in the literature, in the scientific literature. You go into each paper and see, indeed, did they use the NanoHub or a tool or in what fashion, and you categorize those papers. So there, in about a year and a half ago, this was about 575 papers. 82% are in nano research. Those are the red dots. Nano. Then there's green ones. 11% are on cyber infrastructure. And then there is papers now that focus on how you use research, use NanoHub in education, and the mixture. So each dot is a paper, and it's connected by common authors. Those are the white lines. So you see networks of papers forming out here outside of the central core of NCN papers. The cool thing is 56% of the dots are outside that central core of papers that are associated with us. So that's one way of looking at it. You can now go, oh, by the way, this is corresponds to 1,200 authors. Actually, I can update these numbers. 719 papers with 1,400 authors. And I can now color code these nano papers slightly differently. We actually went in through all these nano research papers and tried to figure out if they contain experimental data or if they even contain an experimentalist as an author, where it's really experimental work and computing is being used as support. It turns out the number of papers that have experimental data is 30%. That's significant. You can color these and you can actually see experimentalist networks out here. And of course, we're well connected to experimental work on the inside because that's how we know how to drive tools. But that was not believed as such, per se, as being done possible, especially we're not connected to those guys. We're not holding their hand, right? We're not going there and having a specialized, dedicated consultant spending a half a year with those groups. All right. So this is a proof that it can be worked, used in experimental work, and it can leave geeks' hands like me and be useful to others. All right. Now, once I showed some of those social network charts, the next question was, okay, you can do research. But it can't be good research, right? Because they're still not building their own tools. They can't possibly do really good research because they don't know what they're doing. I mean, that was the underlying tone, right? So can we prove that you can do good research? So I'm not sure if you're familiar with something called the age index, but that's one way of trying to quantify goodness of research. So what you typically do is, say you look at this young faculty member 3 years after his PhD, and you take his papers and the number of secondary citations. So he has one paper that's been cited about 40 times or 50 times, and the second one that's been cited 30 times, and so on. In all, he has 6 papers that have been cited more than 6 times, or at least 6 times. So his age index is 6. And with being 3 years out of school and at being six, he's doing really well. In fact, you usually argue on average, if you're N years out of your PhD, your age index should be N. And then it sort of course, tops out, and it tops out typically like with people like that are members of Academy of Engineering. That's sort of a lifetime achievement type person, right? That's a lifetime achievement award. So here's a person, he has 37 papers that have been cited at least 37 times. So the question now is, if you have NanoHub with his 575 papers and 3,200 secondary citations, could you figure out if NanoHub were considered a co-author sort of on these papers or an enabling agent for these papers, what's the age index of NanoHub? Because remember, you can't do good research, right? So the question is, can you? So here, NanoHub's age index is 27, and the first publication that cites NanoHub is now 10 years old. So our age index should be 10 on average. So we're doing quite well. Actually, if I update these numbers, it's actually 719 papers, and the age index is up to 30. So I think this is a quantitative proof that an organization like this can not only do research, but it can be good research. So we also wanted to have economic impact. That would mean we have to somehow be used by industry or connect to industry. If we look at these social network charts that actually analyze these papers by author affiliations, 8.7% of the authors are in industry. I worked in industry for 4 years. I can tell you I was writing my papers at night. That was not my primary job. So actually having some 9% of the authors being at industry is actually quite a good number, I think. I mentioned this tool that has almost perfect scaling on the biggest supercomputer in the world. We transfer that. It's being used now at Intel in two groups, in the TCAT groups and at the strategic research group. Also, I have a good friend of mine was at some point just burstingly using one of the tools on the NanoHub, and as an analysis, I followed up with him. He said, yeah, that worked really well. I was generating a patent. Thank you very much. There's another tool out there. It's a virtual instrument, actually. There's a kind of cool story on the side. It's Arvind Raman's Vida code that simulates how an STM tip would see a surface. So people can learn about STM technology. They can put in structures and see what they would look like if they were actually to measure it. Now, this tool is being used by all three AFM manufacturers in the United States. And we have a cool comment from them, from one of them here. We find it useful. It helps us make better choices in designing new probes, and it helps us check our own results. So we can transfer things like that in industry. Now they're starting to combine this virtual instrument with a virtual growth. So you can virtually grow something and then imagine with a model how you would measure it and how it would look like. And that is now with a new partnership with Dow, which then funded these original authors of these tools to actually build new tools. So finally, the major point I wanted to drive home is we wanted to do community building. And they can develop around tools, they have to involve the researchers, and they have to deal with some of the publications. So here's a person I work with very closely, Dragica Vasileska. She put a lot of content on NanoHub, including tutorials, seminars, etc. She also puts up 17 tools, and they have served now today over 8,000 users. And we give a chart like this, which is sort of the monthly users and the integral users to all authors that have tools. Because they can take that chart and put it into the next NSF proposal and say, look, I'm not just dreaming of having an outreach program. I'm actually doing it. And this proposal here will just enhance that and allow me to do more. And it's quantitative. And then Dragica and another co-author and I start to publish books on how computational electronics works, some of the tools work on NanoHub. It's a new way of delivering books and content and capabilities. Here's a story of a more junior person. Sheikh Ahmed was a postdoc in my group. And in the time he was in my group and at ASU beforehand, He created some 8 tools and that served 6,000 users. And, you know, even the best postdoc at some point has to leave and find a new job. And he did. He went to Southern Illinois. And basically, the usage of NanoHub upon of his arrival there burst up dramatically. So there was a lot of users there, a lot of usage. He integrated NanoHub into his curriculum, into his research at a university that didn't have that infrastructure at hand. And then he sent me an email, said they put me up to promotion 2 years after he got there. And he got it. And his department chair actually made a point and sent me a note that said NanoHub did have an extremely positive impact on his rapid movement towards tenure. Another building of communities is around having NanoHub other places. So here is NanoHub on iTunes U. So we're considered one of the 68 or so institutions that Apple considers a university or a university-like entity. It's very hard to get in there. It's actually not trivial to be considered part of the in-group. We derive about 10,000 downloads per month on that. A year ago, we started to actively contribute to Wikipedia in a very constructive form, where we took our animations and content items and lectures and seminars that are relevant to strong wiki pages and linked them there or contributed in there. These graphs and animations make it in other languages. The Germans obviously know what a buckyball really looks like. And our usage or derived visits, number of visits that come from Wikipedia rose up dramatically to some 4,000 visits per month. So it's a way to actually make Wikipedia stronger, give it valid content, because they really don't want to be a link farm. We tried that first, right? Just sort of link, yeah, here's more stuff. You actually have to make those pages better. And you derive a benefit out of that and link back. All right. So I guess NSF, Mike Groko, did at some point call us now the largest nanotechnology user facility in the world. We are focused about modeling, simulation, and software. We have seminars, tutorials, and classes. I try to convince you that we are successful in knowledge transfer. I mean, we can always do more. We do knowledge generation. We have economic impact, and we work on professional development and community building. And what I presented are sort of the outcomes, right? I didn't talk about the methodology and what you need to consider, what flows in that. How do you build a community? How do you invest your money? In what places do you put your money? What you really have to do is you have to bring requirements together. So you have to have developers' requirements in mind. You have to have the users' requirements in mind, and also the CI operation, and putting that all into one big box. And then you can have a vibrant and impactful virtual organization. So today, Lynn Zentner will talk about some of the success criteria that I needed to put this all together into a box that you might want to consider if you're trying to build up a community and figure out what are the critical things you need to consider and where do you need to place your money. Because I can guarantee you it's not in the tool building. Okay? The tool building you actually have to take from somewhere else. I guess the bottom line. If your proposal reads like, give me a lot of money and I will build a tool, you will not get it to the real user. That tool almost has to be built. You almost have to sit on top of it. I worked for 10 years. I have a tool. I'm going to make it useful. And now I need funding for all these other key elements to make it useful. So with that, I'll leave you with my concluding slide. Thank you.
All right. Terrific. Well, while we're getting Tim Sands set
up next, maybe we'll take one question.
So I'm an even greater fan of NanoHub now. That was a great talk. Can you say anything further about the extent to which the NanoHub has created been a catalyst to bring people together in ways that they wouldn't have otherwise, or that, you know, was that when you show this joint publishing, I mean, do you know the difference between groups that evolved through NanoHub versus preformed groups that were using NanoHub, or can you anecdotally point to any kind of breakthrough things that have occurred that arguably wouldn't have occurred without NanoHub?
I mean, I would have anecdotal information, but I don't have systemic information where I look, there's a social network out there, and these two people had never published together, and this is the first paper that they published together. That's sort of the next thing to study in a formalized sense. Certainly, this whole idea of sharing codes stemmed from the origin of Mark Lundstrom getting a phone call saying, do you have a postdoc ready or a student ready? And he said, yeah, I do, but what do you want? Well, I need to simulate this. And he said, Mark said, well, I can do that today. I have the code. The guy goes, does it run on a PC? Mark said, of course not. I run on real computers. No, he didn't say that. But no, it runs on Unix. And that was the starting point of Punch, this Purdue University Network Computing Hub. It was started from non-existing collaborations and sharing information. And anything else is sort of anecdotal, but in terms of studying quantitatively, we haven't done that yet. It's really painful to do that. It's not trivial.
Anecdotally, do you want to talk about the guy that did the nanowire simulator from Korea?
Oh, Mitchell.
Yeah. Sorry to put you on. That's my question. Anecdotally, would you like to talk about that?
Oh, yeah, that's fine. So I suddenly got contacted by a person that wanted to build a nanowire tool, and eventually he did come and visit us. He adopted the Rapture environment. He runs on NanoHub. He contributed, and he went back to Korea. And that is indeed something that didn't exist. Another thing is, talking of nanowires, there was a student getting like 3-4 different accounts and beating on the system mercilessly. We tracked it down and said, well, that's fine. Why didn't you just ask for more resources? And I said, oh, I didn't know I could. And then now he's in my research group.